Welcome to another edition of Global Lithium Q&A, where I answer your questions on the lithium industry, and from time to time, we bring on special guests to discuss pertinent issues. Thanks for listening. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Icebreaker, the finest 100% merino wool garments on the planet, and something that I have used for almost 20 years and wear on a daily basis. My first question today comes from Keegan via Twitter. Hopefully I'm pronouncing your name properly. Keegan's a friend of the podcast. I had several interactions with him via social media, and he really wanted to know about lax ponds, and from an aerial picture he saw, his perception that they were a little different than other ponds he'd seen. Let me just comment on when you're designing ponds for a brine project, it's about taking full advantage of or maximizing the value of the local climatic conditions. You orient the ponds so that you get the maximum prevailing wind benefit, which creates some waves on the ponds. And you also obviously want to take full advantage of the solar situation. So there's the orientation aspect, and then building ponds, particularly the ponds at Cauchari, is a massive exercise of moving ground. And, I think this is the largest earth moving project in Argentina, currently in progress. So in designing for the flat bottom of the pond, you really want to minimize the amount of ground that you move, and you design it that way. And you take the topography into consideration, the slope of the land, and work it out. So, it's kind of like you maximize what God's given you there. And, the ponds look like the ponds look when you're finished. So there's no real super complex answer. Obviously, lax ponds are huge, and they were designed that way for a reason. And so there's not a secret sauce answer I can give you. I did contact LAC and verify their comments on the matter. So Keegan, I hope that answers your question, but that's all I got on that topic. Question two is going back to the question I was asked about Livent and Albemarle's earnings calls, and I couldn't answer the Albemarle part of that the other day because they didn't have their call when I recorded that podcast. So now I have heard the Albemarle earnings call, and it's really kind of a continuation of the way Albemarle handles things. I think the JP Morgan downgrade the day after says as much about it as I can. So a lot of what they said was factual, and a lot of what they said, I believe, is less than factual. Obviously they're under price pressure like everybody else. That is pretty well accepted that whether we're at the low point of pricing in China with both technical and battery quality product in China selling at prices below $10 a kilo. And admittedly, I didn't think battery quality pricing would go below 10 on a sustained basis, even in China. I got that one wrong. But I would also reiterate that the pricing in Q4 so far going into Korea and Japan is pretty much still at double figures. So that being 10 or above, there may be a few nines mixed in there. But I'm relatively confident that Korea and Japan, being the two countries that are really mostly going to tier one battery are more representative of what I think is going to be the long-term new normal. But let's get back a little bit to the call. Eric Norris said a couple of interesting things when he's talking about 622 cathode, saying, you know, Albemarle's the only producer that can play both carbonate and hydroxide. And that is absolutely false. Gangfen can do both and probably does a higher volume of both products into 622, particularly in the China situation that was being referenced. So I don't know why things like that get said when they're clearly not in fact true. You know, Luke made a big deal about being in the middle of negotiations, but you know, and obviously this time of year there's a lot of customer contact on price for next year. But when you take all the things that Albemarle said about their great long-term contracting strategy and their price protection, and that, you know, they've said multiple times, you know, they've locked in these volumes, you know, obviously contracts have to be managed based on customer need and what they see as their volume needs. But it's really clear from the way both Luke and Eric talked about things yesterday that that whole contracting strategy didn't give them the kind of protection that they claimed, and particularly on the downside. Another point I would make is that I was really surprised to see that they use Benchmark and Asian Metals to talk about price rather than just stating what their prices actually are, like SQM does. Sorry, I have to let my dog in the room. So anyway, it was, in my mind, kind of more of the same of the way Albemarle talks about the market and about, you know, their situation. You know, I think a lot of people were waiting to hear about Wojina, however you want to pronounce it. I'm not going to beat that horse. I always thought that the value they gave up was really a transfer payment to Mineral Resources shareholders from Albemarle shareholders. I know there are some that think that it was a great strategic play because they, you know, maybe now they're able to just hold it off the market, which they obviously are. But I mean, paying over $1 billion to do that seemed a little pricey. I guess the other thing of interest to me was kind of the comment that they're still not world class in Chile at La Negra. You know, it's just this La Negra thing is an ongoing saga. We've heard multiple times on earnings calls that everything's going to be ramped like next quarter or next year, depending on which call you're referring to. And it's just, it never kind of ends, that they just can't get La Negra to operate at a consistent high volume level. And, you know, now they said, okay, we got to the best production we ever had in October, and, you know, we need to keep that going. Well, we'll see. But 38,000 tons out of La Negra in 2019 is hardly something that I would declare as a victory. So, again, I didn't expect to hear a lot new on that earnings call. And so I'm going to just, you know, it's easy for me to beat the dead horse, because Albemarle just makes it really easy to be critical of what they say. But I'd really love to see them, one, be more candid, and two, perform better. And it's as simple as that. Question three comes from London, and it's Joe. Now that you've heard the earnings calls this week and seen more banks comment, what can you tell us about where you see the industry going in 2020 and 2021. I probably don't really think about it exactly that way. I tend to look out and think that this is a long-term play. And you know, when I've talked about new normals and I've talked about the industry, it's really in the context of seeing a change in, you know, e-transportation. And that's going to take, that's not a 12 to 24 month scenario for me. It's, you know, 5 to 10 years. And, trying to answer that question, I would say, let me just go back and harken back to the JP Morgan, report that came out, right, you know, after Albemarle on their commentary, and they show a supply and demand model. And I don't really have, it goes to 2023. I don't really quibble with their supply. I think they have supply in 2023 is just a little over 700,000 tons. You know, 3 years out, just being at the end of 19, let's just say 19 is just about over. But they show growth. I really dispute or would take issue with their demand forecast, because they show a very tepid increase next year. They have demand going up from, you know, very, very limited amount from 300 to 327 next year, and then only to 359 in 2021. And let me just put that in the context of a tweet I put out the other day that showed that if you annualize year-to-date September, and I think 9 months is usually pretty good data on imports in Korea and Japan from which to extrapolate, they're actually both countries will import roughly 60,000 tons of combined carbonate and hydroxide. So it's 120,000 tons. Almost all of that goes into battery. That is up from last year, about 30,000 tons. And this is just in Japan and Korea. And even though China's situation has been often talked about, that market's not shrinking. It's just not growing as fast as some people thought. And the EV growth rate, you know, took a pause this year. And that's one thing that I agreed with Albemarle's comments yesterday or 2 days ago, was that EV probably just took a pause in China. But my point being is that this is to the top tier. Japan and Korea make cathode that will be going into the high-end EVs. And that growth, just those two countries, is basically more than JP Morgan shows as, you know, happening. And you know, that's my comment is that I don't quibble with JP Morgan's, you know, supply, but I do quibble with their demand. And that is really pretty much the same situation with Morgan Stanley. So although it's really easy to say in the short term, oh, these guys were right because they predicted the price would decline, you know, I'll continue to say that. I predicted the price would decline too. I didn't think it would go as low in China as it went, but I also think that's a short-term thing. And I think if you believe JP Morgan's numbers, getting to 700,000 in 2023 supply, and you believe that it's going to, we're looking at a million ton market or even high, mid to high eights in 2025, the industry hasn't had the investment to do that. The industry hasn't had the chemical investment to even do the 700,000 in 2023. So with that in mind, this is why I don't think that there is this massive long-term oversupply. I think we're at a blip because of all the mines coming on in Australia and the Qinghai carbonate and some other factors that I've talked about in the past. And again, I think we're going to see a tightening in the market, but I don't see price going up until this time next year, and price going up in a meaningful way. But again, I'll still say I think the long-term battery quality price is over 10. It's closer to 12 plus. But at the end of the day, I also don't think that matters if you're invested in a top-tier lithium player. And really what's going to define the long-term price is what's the high end of the cost curve. And, you know, I think taking everything into consideration, the cost curve is going to support pricing that is above 10,000 long-term. So that's pretty much it. I think 2019, as I wrote on LinkedIn, is pretty much a gap year for the lithium world. 2020, I think things start to improve from the standpoint of, you know, the supply and demand are more in balance. And there's one other comment that Albemarle made in their call that I'll go back to, is that I believe Eric Norris said that they believe that there's at least 6 months of carbonate in the supply chain. I do not believe there is that much, and I certainly don't believe there's that much battery quality. So the other key point is it's in the supply chain, but it's not at the cathode producers. It's more being held other places, and that would more be with the producers. And if you're going to have 40,000 tons or 50,000 tons of growth next year, that inventory is going to get worked off pretty quickly, because look at what the big five players have done capacity wise this year. SQM's not going up a significant amount. I mean, they are on a path to increase their production, but it isn't a massive increase. Albemarle's already admitted their struggles. Livent is not going to be significantly higher next year. Actually, I think they've pretty much declared that the only reason they're going to have more output is because they're going to have to buy more source carbonate. Ganfeng's capacity is kind of held flat this year. They will have another increase next year at Xinyu, I believe. And then, you know, obviously Talison's kind of pulled in their horns at Kwinana. So the top five guys are not going to flood the market next year with more supply. So I'm of the mind that, you know, the industry's at a point where it's taking a breather, and it's about to, the forces are in place with the new EV models, with the higher than expected demand in storage. This is going to play out, and it's going to play out over the next few years. And, you know, you've heard me say it before, so I will end that answer right here. Rapid fire comes from Australia. The question is, Joe, what is the best single piece of advice you've ever been given? And, you know, that's a little bit of a Tim Ferriss question, which I've heard a lot of answers to from listening to his podcast. My answer to that would be, basically, life is short, and don't be afraid to take calculated risks. And I think that is, I've heard that over the many years I've been on the planet from multiple people. And I think the mistakes that I have made in my life have been more around being afraid to take action from time to time. And so I'll leave it at that. And I would say it's good advice to most people, is to, you know, put your fears behind you and step out and take that risk that you've thought through. So that is my answer to rapid fire. I will be traveling the next couple of weeks, and we'll actually be recording some episodes of the Global Lithium Podcast with Emily Hirsch in California at Cathodes. I think you will enjoy the guests we've been able to secure for that. And then I will move on to Asia. I may record a couple of these from Asia because it's pretty simple to do with a good internet connection. So we'll see. But in any case, there will be a couple episodes of the Global Lithium Podcast coming out in the next month, maybe three. And with that, I will end this episode. This has been another episode of Global Lithium Q&A. For more on the lithium industry, you can follow me on Twitter, at Global Lithium, on LinkedIn, where I've published more than 100 articles on the lithium space, or at www.lithiumpodcast.com for the Global Lithium Podcast, which I co-host with Emily Hirsch. And it's also available on most major podcast outlets. Once again, thanks for listening.